Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. I'm recording this intro the day after the midterm elections in the US, which is obviously an important moment for Americans and many people all over the world. For many of us, the results seem to reflect a troubling level of polarization in the US. But they also reflect a high level of engagement with the political process, which I think is a very encouraging sign, no matter what side of the spectrum you're on. This topic of political engagement is the theme of the podcast today. It's an increasingly important issue for me personally, because I think that engagement is an important aspect of the resilience of communities, but also the health and well-being of individuals. I did a deep dive into these issues with Kim Manning, someone who lives and breathes these issues every day. Kim is a professor at Concordia University here in Montreal and the principal of its Simone de Beauvoir Institute. After many years of research and social justice work, Kim recently made the jump into politics. She's currently running to be the Federal Liberal Party's nominee in the riding of Outremont in Montreal. And as you'll hear, she has a lot to say about how her sense of purpose and her commitment to her values has been transformational both for her and for her community. In our conversation, we talked about her personal experience with a gender nonconforming family member that inspired her to become an advocate for the transgender community. We talked about her role in supporting Bill C-16, and confronting its critics, including Jordan Peterson, the U of T professor who became pretty famous for all of his critiques of the bill. We talked about all the excitement and all the challenges of her political campaign, and how her family, her sense of purpose, her meditation practice, and even some Zumba classes help her maintain a modicum of balance in her crazy life. To find out more about Kim and her work, you can visit kimmanning.ca. That's kimmanning.ca. Now, over the years working as a psychologist, I've really come to appreciate that mental health is more than just the absence of disease. It also involves the promotion of the positive aspects of life, including gratitude, compassion, purpose, and meaning. And this intuition is increasingly supported by the research in positive psychology. If you're interested in this work, I would highly recommend working with an ACT therapist, that's acceptance and commitment therapy, or developing a meditation practice, of course. And so these services are available at Mindspace and at Presence. And more information is available at mindspacewellbeing.com and presencemeditation.ca. And now, here's my conversation with Kim Manning. Okay, Kim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Joe.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good, good. Let's start by you just giving us a little intro into what you do and how you got into doing what you do.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's been really great to reconnect with you after a few years apart. And so it's fun to get a chance to talk in this context. So I'm currently the principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute at Concordia University. I've been teaching at Concordia since 2004. And I was originally hired to teach Chinese politics. So my background is very much focused on not so much contemporary Chinese politics, but looking really at the revolutionary era, 1940s, 1950s. So many of my sort of formative years in graduate school and prior to that were spent in China, both doing research and language study. The last few years, however, things have taken a bit of a turn, and my research and my teaching have shifted away from Chinese politics per se, toward a greater focus and expression of what is one form of social action research here in Canada. And that's in part what led me to become the principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute 3 years ago.
What is social action research?
Okay, so social action research is an approach to research where you essentially know what the problem is. You know, it's been well defined, clearly understood as a pre-existing problem, often social problems. And the researcher, instead of trying to continue to define the problem and maybe a new theoretical understanding of the problem, actually enters research with the intention to transform. So it's a very different kind of approach from the idea of the researcher as an objective external outsider. And there are many, many different forms of social action research. And in my own approach and in the work of the folks that I've been working with over the last few years, there's been both a highly personal dimension to the research, as well as a real commitment to activating new bodies of knowledge and new networks, and also organizational kinds of approaches to transformation. And specifically, the work that I've been doing has been very much an allyship with the LGBTQ and the transgender community.
Yeah, so I would love to hear about all that stuff, but I think for the purposes of this discussion, maybe we can get into the personal side of that.
Okay.
And this transformative experience you had over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the neat things for me about reconnecting with you is that when I took the MBSR course back in 2011, I was literally just coming in. I just applied for my first grant related to, in particular, to parent advocacy on behalf of transgender children. And so I kind of knew you in this sort of this moment of transition for myself. And I remember getting the grant that June. And it was also at the same time my family had moved to Outremont as well. For me, it was a highly personal shift that I was taking at that moment. A close family member of mine who was at that point in time very gender nonconforming and potentially transgender. And that really galvanized me when I was looking out at the world and looking at the very unwelcoming state of the world for people who are non-binary, not identifying as male or female, or who are transgender in the sense that they don't identify with the gender that they were assigned at birth. And so for me, that was very galvanizing and really prompted me to, in a sense, cultivate new allies and new friendships and new ways of trying to approach this problem. So instead of trying to fix this close family member of mine, really approaching this is actually a societal problem and we need to fix society rather than this particular individual who I was close to.
I'm not sure that this will be necessary, but it might be. I'm just wondering if you could clarify some of those terms.
Okay.
So you mentioned non-binary.
Right.
Gender non-conforming.
Yes.
Transgender.
Yes.
There may be another one. And I have a feeling the nuance there is important.
Yes, absolutely. So for individuals who are non-binary, again, they don't necessarily identify as feeling particularly like a woman or like a man. And their preference is to really not be classified as one or the other. And as you might imagine, that's still very, very hard in our world, which, you know, as you can, almost any institution still requires an M or an F on all kinds of documentations. So that is a real challenge. People who are transgender, the term transgender is a much larger, wider kind of catch-all term. And it can sometimes be used in reference to non-binary people, but it tends to be used more frequently in reference to people who don't identify you know, when they were born, the doctor said, looking at genitals, saying, okay, well, this is a boy or this is a girl. And then as that person evolved and grew, in fact, did not identify with that gender. So that's important. Now, being transgender doesn't necessarily mean you have medical intervention or surgery or any of this. It's really based on how you feel you are, who you are inside. And I think that's really important for folks to understand. In my work, we also talk about gender nonconforming or gender nonconforming expression or behavior. And that can mean that, you know, lots of people can be gender nonconforming in all kinds of ways. Doesn't mean that they're transgender. It may mean that, for example, you know, a 18-year-old guy going out to the club likes to wear skirts and lipstick, and that's a way of going to the clubs and dancing for the night. Doesn't mean they're gay, doesn't mean they're straight, doesn't mean they're trans. It's just a form of self-expression. So there are all kinds of subtleties and I think important distinctions in this world. But what we're finding, I think, and this is very interesting, is that in this cultural moment, there is more space. I mean, we're still living in a highly transphobic time, a time where, you know, it's still very, very difficult on multiple levels to be transgender. But things have changed enormously just in the last 6-7 years since we first met. I mean, it's the world has shifted, particularly in large cities, from when I first started entering this sphere. So that's exciting. It's encouraging. And yet there still remains lots and lots of work to do. And you can see that, you know, for example, in the United States, there's been backlash underway with the Trump administration and all kinds of ways in which it's become more difficult again to be transgender.
So you mentioned that the approach that you're taking yourself and bringing to your research and presumably with your colleagues is to address this issue as a societal problem, mm-hmm. and not like a pathology or
right.
some aberrant behavior
Absolutely.
By the
yes.
individual.
Yeah.
Maybe you can just speak to why that mm-hmm. shift is important
okay.
in your mind.
So, yeah, for a long time, as you probably well know, given your clinical background, gender nonconforming behavior, transgender individuals were largely treated as symptomatic of some kind of mental health issues, right? That they needed to be treated for as if they were in some way mentally incapacitated. That approach, in part because of deep work by now several generations of folks in the social sciences and sociology, in the humanities as well, who have been arguing, actually, you know, again, this is not a pathology. This is just a part of human expression. Right. And we in the West have just been extremely limited in our understanding and our recognition of human diversity. So I think that's the first thing. But the second thing is because, again, my area of work and my advocacy has been alongside of and in support of young people who are transgender and gender nonconforming. And what has emerged, I think, very significantly over the last, again, 6, 7, 8 years, is a whole new body of research. And what that research is telling us is that young people who have the support of their parents and their communities, their religious communities, you know, the people who surround them, but most importantly, the family and the parents, young people who are supported, their incidences of self-harm, suicidal ideation and actual attempts at suicide drop dramatically. One study suggested by 93%, you know, like, I mean, really, really dramatic. This is very significant because in the past, clinical researchers have looked at trans people and said, oh, 43% you know, risk of suicide. Wow, something's really wrong with, you know, this whole population. Well, again, that's not internally generated. That's in response to the stress of living in a deeply transphobic society.
So you get involved in advocating for this relative of yours. Mm-hmm. Maybe just tell us what happened there. And I think it was transformative for you personally.
Oh.
I'm curious to hear about how that happened.
Yeah. So in many ways, I mean, there were a number of things that personally were happening for me over the last few years as I was supporting this person who I'm very close with. Part of it was that I, in my own research, independent of the social action research I was doing, I was also completing a major book that I've been working on for a long time on the Chinese Revolution. And in fact, my editor at Cornell is waiting for that final manuscript. I'm trying to find. So maybe when I take that leave, you know, when I'm finally an official nominee, that's when I'll be. It's not going to take long. I just need about a month to get that done. So, but part of it was finishing that book project and really having the confidence to speak my truth, to really lay claim to an area that I'd done a lot of work in for a long time, and really have the courage just to really say, to really define and lay out how I saw this particular period and what the contributions were that I had to bring. So that was happening at the same time I was also emerging as an advocate for this person in my life who I'm close to. And these were in some ways reinforcing developments, because I was needing to take risks to emerge publicly and, you know, begin to hold press conferences, go to schools, give training at schools, support other people who were going through similar kinds of experiences that I was going through.
Why did you have to do those things?
Oh, I didn't have to. But for me, it, in many ways, it felt like there became a point where there were other people around me who were emerging and doing public work, and someone that I'm very close to, who actually, there was one particular moment, who was very far away when things kind of hit the fan in the media, and this friend of mine was in South Africa doing research, and it was at that moment actually that my husband and I said, okay, we're gonna step out now. We're gonna step out into a kind of a public moment. And it was actually my husband who wrote the not an op-ed, but just a letter to the editor in the Globe and Mail, kind of responding to what was happening in that moment.
Yeah, what was that moment you said when things hit the fan?
Well, it was a columnist with the Globe and Mail had misgendered the child of a friend of mine in the paper, and was making light of, not making light, but was questioning the choices that were being made about how this child was being raised and affirmed. And so Jason, my husband, penned just a short but very clear piece about individuals who were advocating on behalf of family members, particularly young family members, do not take this work lightly, right? And it involves a great deal of self-reflection, and this is not a jumping on the bandwagon. This is not because it's cool. These are not decisions that are taken lightly, but they were being presented in such a way that these are individuals who are jumping on some kind of pro-trans activist bandwagon, as if this is, you know, a trendy thing to do, when it is anything but.
Sure. So you kind of develop this mission in life, or you become more active mm-hmm. in advocating.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that translate into becoming politically active and getting involved with the Liberal Party?
So, you know, again, different streams happening at the same time. So 3 years ago, I became principal at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute. And for me, when I came into that role, I think one of the reasons I was asked to step into that role was because of the emerging advocacy that I was doing and the way in which my research had been shifting. When I came into the role at Concordia, though, for me, what I really began to see was that I wanted to continue working alongside the transgender community. And I have continued to do so, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But I also really was recognizing how many of the issues that I care about are so deeply intersecting. You know that there's this. It's the idea of one. For example, rights-based approach, which I have also been very active in terms of addressing some of the needs of the trans community. In fact, there's so many other issues that compound how many different trans people experience the world. And in the case of, you know, my family and the person who, you know, I've been striving to protect, in many ways they have a lot of resources and support that many other people don't. So for me, it became a kind of a moving into a kind of opening up the advocacy and really working my way into thinking about equity and how to make, in my role at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute, how to use that role as a way to help the university to open up and become more affirming from a wider understanding of equity, right? So I've been doing a lot of work around race and all kinds of other issues that intersect with this original advocacy, but don't necessarily always align just on that one hue to that one issue. So that was happening. And then the other significant thing for me last spring in particular was having an opportunity to work with some key members in the Senate to try and get some major legislation approved, which was Bill C-16. And Bill C-16 was written to protect gender identity and gender expression in the Human Rights Code. So it was expanding the Human Rights Code and the Criminal Code, you know, under what can be protected in that legislation. And for me, it was about a 6-week, 2-month period where I co-wrote three different opinion editorials and went to Ottawa, I think three times, twice presenting to different Senate committees on this issue. And that experience for me, not only presenting and actually having an opportunity to lay out some arguments in front of people who'd been opposing the legislation and opposing it for a very long time. And these are some of those people were people I'd actually written about in my academic work. So this was a very, very powerful, galvanizing moment to actually sit there and say, this is why this is important. This is how this law can help to change the way we look at other people who you say are human beings and deserve respect and dignity, but this is how it's actually going to impact them, right? So having that opportunity to make that case was very powerful. And also seeing people up close. In my case, you know, working with a senator originally from Alberta who was so deeply invested in getting this legislation passed. And I, you know, I was on the phone as he was preparing his speech and he is asking questions and wanting to get it right and so invested in really making as powerful a speech as he could. That was hugely moving, you know, or seeing Jody Wilson-Raybould, our Minister of Justice, the moment when the legislation passed into law by a landslide and her turning around and having tears on her cheeks, right? That That is extraordinary. It just gave me shivers to actually see public servants that invested in trying to create change. And so that's really the moment when I began to think about, okay, how can I, something I've long thought about, but never concretely in a way of, could I actually make a move in this direction? That's when I thought, no, this is where I can make a major contribution.
At the risk of taking a detour or kind of introducing a parenthesis here for a second, because this is really the heart of what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
The sense of purpose that moved you into this new role, even though you know, have a great career and you're very active and maybe even at the peak of your academic success, making a major life change with a family and all that. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. So Bill C-16, if I'm thinking of the right legislation, became a very hot topic in the media.
Yes.
And if I'm, again, getting this right, it was particularly a critic of Bill C-16 that made it very public, and that's Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
And so how are you reading what he was up to? And maybe actually if you could just summarize, I could summarize.
Why don't you summarize his position?
So I'll do my best, but definitely correct me if I'm getting some of the facts wrong. So Jordan Peterson is a University of Toronto psychology professor, and full disclosure, a former mentor of mine.
That's right. Yeah.
And a somewhat middling academic for most of his career. I believe he's in his 50s now, but very bright and had a very sort of up and down. I'm not going to say that. For reasons that aren't totally clear, he heard about this legislation and decided it was very important for him to fight it. And he fought it on the grounds basically of a free speech position. And he claimed that the legislation was coercive in compelling people to use the pronouns of transgender individuals' choice. And so he felt that was unfair, and he has a very elaborate and abstract argument that it is a sort of an outcome of a extreme left ideology that is making its way into law, and he felt that was really inappropriate.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I've summarized that correctly, I'd be very curious to hear your point of view on that.
Okay, sure. So first of all, I've never met Jordan Peterson, and I actually have not read, for example, his most recent book or his academic pieces. So all I've seen are snippets here and there in the context of short media sound bites and some of what he did in the Senate, for example, because he presented a couple of weeks after me in the Senate. And I will also say, you know, that he's somebody with a strong Jungian background, right? And I mean, that the Carl Jung's work actually was hugely formative in my own psychology, if you will. And so it's somewhat not humorous, but I see the there's something about me where I think, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting that he could end up there and I could end up here, right? And, you know, thinking about meaning and purpose and, you know, all of that. So, you know, I think the other thing, too, that's interesting here, and I'll, you know, a couple of other parallels. So some of the things I've read about him are that, you know, he's done a lot of reading about Soviet propaganda and ideology, and he's
Chinese as well.
And so he's extremely wary of these kind of leftist movements and the overriding of the individual liberty, I think. And that's a core concern of his. And quite frankly, it's a concern I share, and it's not one that I take lightly either. And it's not one that I want to easily dismiss, right? I mean, I'm a student of Maoism. I've spent years studying Maoism. And not just, you know, secondhand. I've interviewed people, I've read archival documents, I've been steeped in that world and in the propaganda of that world and literally how people saw themselves and others in the context of that highly ideological period in time. And it's not something that I think we should be striving to reproduce in any way, shape, or form in terms of the way it does close down our capacity to engage with one another, to have dissent, to be creative, even as there was a certain passionate expression and there was an intention to create a better society, certainly. And I don't want to undermine that aspiration either, because that certainly was there. But how that all came into being was deeply flawed, in part because of the increasing rigidity and fear-based nature of the campaigns that were underway. This is something that, you know, and I've talked about this before, actually, in the context of another interview that I did a few months ago. You know, people would be surprised, and maybe Jordan Peterson would be surprised to know that among my colleagues in women's studies, we talk a lot about how do you create and maintain a classroom in which people feel like they feel comfortable, they feel like they can engage, but where the idea of creating safe spaces doesn't mean shutting down the possibility for talking about difficult topics, right? And I think that's one of Jordan Peterson's fears, is that in effect, that you're saying, okay, well, this is a no-go zone, and that's a no-go zone, and trigger warnings, and, you know, how is it there any way that you can have an engaged intellectual life in that context? And so, you know, this is a constant, mm-hmm. and we do pedagogy retreats every year at the Institute. This is something you return to and return to and return to again. It's one of the things I love about the work at the Institute. However, you know, we have both, you know, whether you think about in the context of parliamentary rules, for example, how civic discussion takes place in the chamber, how you refer to people. You know, actually, in that form, there are expectations about how you address one another. And in our daily life, and guided by law, we have expectations about how we're going to interact with one another. So a professor cannot, for example, call a student honey pie because, you know, they think it's a cute name. Right? There are actual guidelines about how we can refer to one another, and there are forms of address that, if repeated over time and with malicious intent, yes, can be seen as a form of harassment, for example. But that's a very rare situation. It's very rare. And we're not, you know, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is providing people with a sense of basic dignity and respect, which again is what we have codified for ourselves and each other in all kinds of forms and changes over time, and that's the part of the society we live in. So to me, this is actually a very reasonable. And not just reasonable, it's part of how we create a society in which we grant each other dignity in the context of our interactions.
So I'm feeling the passion that we talked about before, and I really appreciate it, and I'd like to dip into it a little more.
Yeah.
And thanks for going to the Jordan Peterson thing. It's very controversial, and I know a lot of people wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because it's, so there was that turning point after your political engagement and seeing how many people in the political arena care. So what did you do?
Well, I actually... well, again, and this was the other thing that was extraordinary, because I approached somebody in the Senate who had been, I'd been working closely with, and he had said, you know, I'd really love to see you step into politics in one shape or another. And I said, well, you know, I've actually been a little bit more to the left here, right? And he was like, well, you know, I'll introduce you to some people I know in the NDP. I don't care which party. I just want you to get in there and get involved. That for me was also mind blowing, because I didn't expect that to hear that from, you know, from somebody who'd been committed to one particular party for a long time. So, but I did take time. I did think about, okay, where do my values align? And where do my values, you know, which party is it that my values align with at this particular moment in time? And for me, both in terms of seeing the MPs that I was getting to know, the members of parliament that I was getting to know in the Liberal Party, and the kind of work that they've been doing, whether on LGBTQ issues, whether on housing, I mean, on the environment, on a whole array of pieces, I recognized that this is a place, these are people with whom I can work and with whom I can work productively and who I can help to realize a more progressive Canada. And that's my goal. That's my goal. And so ultimately I said, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take out a membership in this party, and here I go. Plug, you know, like, I'm going to dive in, right? I'm going to actually take this leap and see it, you know. But I, you know, again, but let me backtrack a little bit more too, because it wasn't just the people. So that was a big part of it, the policies that are underway. But I have to say, the other piece for why now is that it's my riding that has opened up. It's where I live. It's where my family and I moved to when we needed a good place, a place that was going to be accepting and create room for us in our own diversity. And so for me, you know, despite the fact that, you know, I'm an Anglophone, I'm originally from British Columbia, you know, my second language is Mandarin, you know, and while I've been working very hard on my French for a long time, you know, it's my third language, you know, despite all of these things, I said, okay, you know what, now is the moment. This is my riding. These are my people. This is the moment.
So you're running for to represent the Liberal Party in the riding of Outremont in the special election coming up. Do I have that right?
Yeah, in the by-election. There'll be a by-election in probably in 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what are you doing to prepare and campaign for that race?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, I'm preparing right now for the investiture, for the nomination to become the Liberal Party's nominee here in the riding. So that's the first step. And that is, and I've just passed the 6-month mark, really, from when I publicly declared that this was something I was going to do. So that was late February. It's hard to know where to begin, because it's been such a huge project and nothing that I could have anticipated when I started. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to have an engaged, participatory, open process, one that aligns with my values, that places equity and inclusion at the heart of the work. But I didn't know how do you do that? How do you do that when you've never been a candidate before, have never been involved in a campaign before. So even though I've studied political science and in particular gender and politics, you know, most of my adult life, I hadn't the experience coming in, either the party experience or the actual campaign experience. So we basically started from scratch, right? And have been building a team that in a sense has usually included between like a core team of between 10 and 15 people, depending on, you know, what various commitments those people have at any given moment in time. We have been onboarding then all kinds of other people in all kinds of different ways, whether people have been a lot of the early months we were hosting meet and greets, you know, one of which you attended, right, where it's an opportunity for me to say this is who I am and this is what I'm trying to do and, you know, could I have your support? Would you consider becoming a member of the Liberal Party and supporting my candidacy? Because in a sense, I've had to build my own Liberal Party in the riding, right? I'm new to the party, and it has meant that I've literally had to start from scratch. So early days with the meet and greets, but now a lot of my work is in the neighborhood. So first of all, I mean, the riding itself is extremely diverse. 25% is the neighborhood of Outremont, right? 25% is the neighborhood of Mile End and a little bit of sort of Northern Plateau. And then 50% of the riding is Côte des Neiges. And Côte des Neiges being an extremely diverse set of neighborhoods in its own right. Half of the riding made up of immigrants and half of those immigrants are new arrivals. So a very from all over the world. And so for me, this over the course of the summer, it's been finding ways through connecting with community organizations, going to events, but also trying to find ways of actually developing relationships with people, of getting to know people at a deeper level, to understand what their lives are like and what kinds of, you know, both needs that they have, what they're looking for in terms of federal representation, but also what they bring to the table, you know. And that's where the engagement for me has become so exciting, because there are a number of people who have gotten involved in the campaign, including from Côte des Neiges, who've never been involved in political work before. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is extremely gratifying.
You used this phrase before, like a few moments ago, you were looking for a party that aligned with your values. I kind of have the impression from watching you go that alignment is a huge thing for you. Mm. And I feel like it's even, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but it's even in the sort of a signature for your campaign. It's like leadership with heart or something.
Yes.
Yeah. Like you're pursuing these ideas, but they're not abstractions for you. This is like the core of who you are.
Yeah. And they're very relationship based.
Right.
Right. So that's a key piece for me, is because for me, good leadership is, yes, it's about listening, it's about understanding, but it's also about creating contexts in which people themselves can become activators and can create new possibilities for themselves, right? I feel like I am succeeding when the people around me are fulfilled and engaged and self-actualized, if you will. And that's tough. It's tough in neighborhoods like Côte des Neiges, right? When you're, you know, dealing with potentially difficult housing situations, when you've been trained for one form of work and you're not able to get a job because of maybe language issues, where you've got family who are in another part of the world, you know, that's a hard call, right? But if there are ways in which you can be bridging some of these pieces, mm-hmm. that to me, if people can really come into their own and feel like, yes, I can make a good life here. Wow.
Right. So this, of course, is an area I'm very interested in. I mean, I do feel like I'd love to talk politics with you and leadership even for hours. But I think I know more about well-being, and I'm really curious about how that alignment that you have achieved so well, what that does to your state of mind. You know, we were chatting before we started recording, and you know, you had a hectic day and probably a hectic week and a hectic summer, and like you're basically always on the go. It must be incredibly draining. It must be incredibly stressful, but you're smiling and you're excited. It's just unbelievable. So I should also say that you're a meditator. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be probably a pretty high level of awareness of how your energies and your moods are going to be evolving. So maybe just speak to that a little
bit. Sure. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things for me, well, first of all, so yes, I'm a meditator. I'm also somebody who has developed a much deeper yoga practice over the last 3 years, particularly since I've begun my work as principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute. That embodied practice has been really, really key for me, given the high level of sociality that is involved in my work. Being able to meditate and practice physically in the context of yoga has been really, really key. There was a moment, 2016, when I became very involved in a campaign on behalf of Homa Hoodfar, who was imprisoned in Iran at that moment. And I became engaged in some of the work liaisoning between the university and what some of the family were doing and trying to create some real momentum behind a public push at that moment in time. It was a period of about a month where it was very, very engaged. It was an emergency, right? And basically, you know, we'd been told that Homa had been taken to the hospital, that she'd collapsed. We did not know if she was going to survive her ordeal. But I remember going to the yoga studio, you know, still at that point in time, two or three times a week, and that the yoga itself allowed me to replenish and maintain my energy during what was in effect a crisis, right? Like that was a crisis. It was, nothing was more important in that moment than getting home a home, right? Now, you know, the alignment, it's easily thrown. There's no question. Right. And I think one of the really interesting things for me, so yes, meditator, yes, yoga. Also, I spent many years, 25 years, I kept a daily journal, right? I've got boxes of these journals. So for me, you know, the reflection and thinking through and processing and the Jungian connection, I've got dream journals has always been really critical. The thing with the campaign is that you have these soaring highs and these crashing lows. I mean, you can literally go from 1 hour feeling like, oh, we're making great progress. We may have a chance at this, to, oh, we're never gonna do this. You know, we're never gonna make it. So for me, a key part of maintaining my capacity to continue at the pace that I am is finding ways to be able to ride these peaks and valleys of campaign life, right? And again, you can be feeling like, oh, you know, again, very excited and things are looking really good, and then something happens and you know, we're never going to get there kind of feeling. And so that's something I think that's a part of anyone's life. It's just more exaggerated in the context of a campaign where the odds are so, the pressure is so high, right? And you're working with a group of people who are all invested on a volunteer basis, right? And you're carrying them as well, but they carry you too, right? And that's one of the beautiful things about doing this work, is at least with the people that I have been working with from the beginning, is this real commitment, I think, to each other and to caring for one another. And there have been moments where some people have had to step back because of other things that have emerged, or family or work or whatever, education needing to go on, and that, you know, making space for all of that and making space for me when I also need to recover too, I think is really key. So alignment, I think, from that perspective, is keeping that sense of perspective. The other piece, though, I would say there are two other pieces that are really important. One is that alignment for me means alignment with that the work I'm doing now, I see as a deep commitment to the realization of strengthening community. And I don't mean this in some kind of like throwaway line. I mean that's the basis of my work at Concordia right now. And my hope is that regardless of the outcome of the nomination or the by-election, that the work I'm doing now will strengthen my university work, for example, if I continue on without in that context instead of in Parliament. But if I have the privilege of going into Parliament, then to me, that community building, the work we've been doing, there's already a basis, a really significant basis for deepening that work. The third thing I would say is that for me, a key piece. So over the course of the summer, I have connected with some folks in the Filipino community, primarily, who participate in Zumba classes in church basements and community centers. I became aware, I was at an event at one point, became aware of some music coming from down in the basement. I said, "What's going on?" Oh, somebody said Zumba. And I said, "Well, I've done Zumba before. Maybe can I come?" And from that first class, I began to connect with people. These Zumba classes are small communities in their own right. They're extremely they're communities that are extremely supportive of one another. They celebrate birthdays. They mark the deaths of relatives. People visiting from outside. Lots of food often posted. You know, so here you sweat your butt off for. And then you eat all this incredible Filipino food that but they're truly strong community ties that are forged in the context of that. But it's also intense exercise, right? And for me, dance has been another my whole life, you know, dancing has always been a way to connect with joy and sometimes euphoria, right? And for me, these Zumba classes, that sense of community, the music, it's been a breakthrough for me personally, and it's changed me in the sense of taking risks of, yes, I'm going to screw up these dance steps or look silly when somebody pulls me onto the stage and I'm, you know, up there shaking my butt and, you know. But it's a way for me to be vulnerable, and I think that's really key in this work of alignment and being open to people and really being able to hear who they are and where they're coming from and how we can connect on the basis of that.
So one thing I'm seeing a lot in my practice and working a lot with in my practice is, of course, it's very important to get cardiovascular exercise and, you know, maintain good relationships with, you know, loved ones. And, you know, there's lots of problem solving to do at times around that. And meditation has become something that people do on a regular basis to stay sort of mentally fit. But what has occurred to me in doing the work that I do is that in some ways it's not enough to solve problems. It's not enough to, so taking meditation as an example, it's not enough to undo the bad habits that we have, that we've developed, or it's not enough to undo the mental bad habits that we've developed. It's not enough to take care of the different pathologies we have in our relationships or in our own minds or whatever, that there's something missing from true well-being, and that is having this deeper sense of purpose.
Yeah.
And I love this quote from Nietzsche, who said, "He who has a why to live can bear almost any how."
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that really intrigues me about what you're doing, is that you have a very strong why. And I, with respect to your comment about riding these waves, these ups and downs, and the relationships you have with people, you guys are all working towards something very deeply important to you. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering how that, what your take is on that, and how the sense of purpose is affecting your life and your relationships and your family life and your energy levels and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for asking that question, because as I have deepened into this work, the question of purpose has actually clarified for me. And I think for me, actually my whole life, I've always seen presenting myself for politics as my ultimate purpose, as for me, where I can be of most service. And I've tried other ways to be of service, teaching and doing research and my parenting, and there's all kind, you know, being a good member of the community, on all of these other things have great meaning for me. But for me, ultimately, what I've realized is that for me myself, because of my personality, because of who I am, I feel like I can be of greatest service if I am in a role where I can be working with people in a capacity as a member of parliament or a legislature to be actually doing that work. To me, that's my that's my highest purpose, I think, at least at this moment in time. And as I've said, you know, it may not play out, but even in the striving for that, there's deep meaning. And truly for me, you know, whether it's the Zumba classes or whether it's being in a mosque for the first time, as I was in June, I have had moments of, it's almost radical vulnerability. And that to me, that sense of aliveness and it's just a tremendous gift for me. And I also see how people respond. So the more I've committed to this path, the more the people around me and the people who are coming to me, I'm meeting extraordinary people in all kinds of communities. So it's like the more alive I become, the more I'm interacting and finding and, you know, opening up to these other people who are extraordinary and doing extraordinary things with their lives. And their higher purpose is different from mine. And wow, look at what you're doing. And isn't this extraordinary? And, you know, and even in my closest relationships, yes, this is hard, right? You know, my kids don't get to see me nearly as often as they did before I started this journey, right? 6 months ago. And there's no question it's hard. It's hard on my husband too, right? It's hard on the kids. And I could talk more about how we manage that whole piece, because that's a whole other, and I think it's a more of a political question, actually, of how you do something like this. And it's, again, reflective of the kinds of systems I want to change around who can actually go into politics, who can make these sort of these attempts at radical vulnerability, if you will. But I will say that the more I've invested in this work and committed to this work, and the happier I've become, the more alive my relationship is with my partner, you know, and with the other people around me. And I know in some ways it's that doesn't make sense in some ways, but it also totally makes sense. And it just affirms for me that, you know, the guy I married 20 years ago, you know, is really the, you know, my right partner in that, you know, if the more alive I become and the more alive he becomes, that there's that connection and mutual support, even three children in and several houses and, you know, all the moves and all the, you know, the various travails of life, right? So that's really extraordinary too.
Yeah, that you talk about feeling alive and all this work giving back in so many ways. You also use the word vulnerable quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I sort of get the impression that we all want that alive feeling, but it does require commitment. It does require taking a risk, and it does require moving out of your comfort zone and making yourself vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's not always easy for people. But when you have that deeper purpose, it gives you the why to bear the how.
So one of the people who, for me, I mean, as I began my journey, you know, again, 7 years ago, and then 3 or 4 years ago, when I, you know, my book and all of these pieces, becoming an advocate, coming into the public arena, it was only after that that I actually started to read Brené Brown's work. And for me, Brené Brown's work really, really for me was, this is what I've been doing. This is what I've been moving into, right? And so it's, but her work is also inspiring because it reminds me of when times are hard and you're questioning yourself and you know, feeling badly because things are hard for whatever reason. It's for me, it's a very inspiring model and a way to remember that, you know, vulnerability, that vulnerability is actually, or that sweet tenderness, as somebody said to me recently, is really the core of who we are. And if we can find ways not to protect it and shield it off from the people around us, but nurture it in such a way and let it open, let the light and the air in, right? That's where we grow, right? That's really where we grow.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. We have, I think, both of us some more mundane concerns to get to.
Children to attend to.
Children and partners needing us and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So why don't we wrap up? But maybe you can just tell us how we might learn about the work that you're doing, and that could be the academic work or information about the campaign.
Sure.
How do we find you?
So different pockets of work, but at Concordia, I'm still there until I actually achieve official nominee status, and continuing to do work around transforming Concordia into Canada's first feminist university. So any listeners out there interested in that work, get in touch. And of course, the campaign work. And if anybody who's listening would like to find out more, my website is kimmanning.ca. Send us an email. Let us know how you'd like to get involved. We'd love, you know, this is where we're growing very, very quickly now, and we need all the support we can get. So thank you. And thank you, Joe, for having me on and getting the opportunity to have this conversation. Like I said, I don't get a lot of chance for reflection right now. So this is a way for me to also think about how this is all coming together and why it's so important at this moment in my life.
The pleasure is all mine. So thanks a lot, and good luck with all these projects. And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.